Ever imagine a world where your neighbor could just accuse you of being a witch?
Oh, wow.
And like the local court might actually agree.
Yeah.
That's how diverse and kind of chaotic American law used to be.
Right.
You've shared this fascinating paper with us, Flatter Einstieg in Amerikanisches Recht.
Yeah.
It's designed to introduce German legal trainees to the American system. So today we're taking a deep dive into the history and evolution of American law,
Okay.
especially the interplay of common law and equity.
It's a journey back to 1066,
Oh, wow.
the Norman conquest of England.
Okay.
A pretty pivotal moment for the development of legal systems we see today.
So rewind almost 1,000 years before written laws were common.
Right?
Imagine trying to settle a dispute with your neighbor. You'd probably gather a group of other villagers, maybe meet under a tree,
Yeah.
and let them decide.
Right.
It was literally a jury of your peers
It was.
interaction.
And if that didn't work,
Yeah.
there was always trial by combat. It's wild to think that determining guilt or innocence could come down to a brawl.
Really?
But buried within this seemingly barbaric practice
Yeah.
are the seeds of some legal concepts we still use today.
Wait, so you're saying there's a connection between a medieval duel and like a modern courtroom?
Absolutely.
Oh, wow.
Think about it. Trial by combat, despite its brutality, introduced the idea of two opposing sides
Okay.
presenting their case and fighting to prove their point. It's a primitive form of the adversarial system we see in courts today,
Okay.
where each side presents evidence and arguments
Right.
to convince a judge or jury.
That's a pretty mind-blowing connection.
It is.
So even though we've thankfully moved away from settling disputes with swords,
Right.
that basic idea of two sides battling it out in court is still very much with us.
It's in our legal DNA.
Yeah.
And as the system evolved, it led to the development of common law
Yeah.
and this crucial concept of precedent.
So precedent means that past legal decisions influence future ones.
Precisely. Each legal decision becomes a building block, a piece of case law that helps judges make rulings in future cases.
Got it.
It creates a framework for consistency and predictability in the legal system.
Okay, I'm starting to see how this all fits together.
Yeah.
But what about the jury?
Yeah.
Where do they fit into this precedent puzzle?
That's a great question.
Yeah.
In the American system, juries are tasked with determining the facts of a case.
Okay.
They listen to evidence, deliberate, and then deliver a verdict,
Right.
guilty or not guilty. But, and this is crucial, their verdict isn't necessarily the final word.
Here's where that infamous hot coffee case comes to mind,
Oh, yeah.
Liebig v. McDonald's.
I remember that one.
That case exploded in the media with the jury awarding millions to a woman
Right.
who was severely burned by spilled coffee.
Yeah, and that's a perfect example of how a jury verdict can grab headlines,
Right.
but doesn't always reflect the final outcome.
Okay.
While the jury's decision is important, the judge ultimately has the power to issue the judgment.
Yeah. Taking into account the jury's verdict, but also considering legal precedent
Okay.
and ensuring the outcome aligns with established legal principles.
So in the McDonald's case, the judge actually reduced the award significantly.
Yes, and that reduction was likely based on legal precedents involving similar cases.
Okay.
It highlights the judge's role in balancing the jury's findings
Right.
with the need for consistency and fairness within the larger legal framework.
The McDonald's case is also a great example of how these legal battles can have a ripple effect
Oh, absolutely.
on the courtroom.
Yeah.
I mean, McDonald's changed its coffee temperature
Right.
and even lobbied for laws to limit damages in similar lawsuits.
Absolutely. Court decisions, even if later modified,
Yeah.
can lead to real-world changes, influencing corporate practices, sparking public debate, and even prompting legislative action.
It's fascinating how a seemingly isolated case can end up impacting things on such a large scale.
It is.
So we've got these building blocks of precedent shaping common law.
But what happens when those established rules just don't fit the situation?
Yeah, that's a good question.
But that's where equity comes in, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Equity emerged as a way to address situations where common law couldn't provide a fair or practical solution.
Like common law was this rigid set of rules,
Yeah.
and equity was the flexible tool that allowed judges to get creative and find solutions that were just, even if they went against the established norms.
You got it.
Okay.
Imagine a king who wants a divorce.
Okay.
But common law, with its focus on monetary damages, doesn't have a mechanism for ending a marriage.
Well, if you're the king, you kind of make the rules, right?
Exactly. The king, unable to get a divorce under common law, created this separate system called equity to address situations where the existing legal framework couldn't provide a fair solution.
So it's like he created a legal loophole for himself?
In a way, yes.
Wow.
But it also led to the development of some incredibly important legal concepts that we still use today. Take injunctions, for example.
Okay.
That's a court order that forces someone to do something or stop doing something.
Like those restraining orders you hear about in celebrity feuds.
Exactly.
Okay.
And specific performance is another concept born out of equity.
Mm-hmm.
This is where a court can force someone to fulfill the terms of a contract rather than just paying monetary damages.
So if I had a contract for someone to paint my house.
Yeah.
And they decided to just pay me a fee instead of actually doing the work, a court could step in and force them to pick up a paintbrush.
That's the idea.
Wow.
And even the concept of a corporation, which limits the liability of investors, came out of equity.
So these were all solutions that just didn't fit within that traditional common law framework, which focused primarily on monetary compensation.
Exactly.
This work, it's interesting. These equity cases weren't decided by juries under a tree. Right.
You're catching on.
Yeah.
Equity cases were handled in a separate court.
Okay.
The Chancery Court.
Right.
By a judge known as the Chancellor.
So instead of a jury of your peers, you'd have this one powerful figure, the Chancellor, deciding your fate.
And here's the kicker. Those Chancery Courts still exist in America today.
Wait, so we've got these two separate court systems operating side by side.
We do.
One based on common law and the other on equity.
That's right.
That seems unnecessarily complicated.
It definitely adds a layer of complexity.
Yeah.
And it gets even more fascinating when you consider the state of Delaware.
Okay, what's the deal with Delaware?
Delaware's Chancery Court has become famous for its expertise in handling complex business disputes.
Okay.
Especially those involving mergers and acquisitions.
So companies flock to Delaware because they know they'll have access to this specialized court system.
Exactly.
That's really good at handling high stakes business battles.
That's right. Delaware has strategically positioned itself as a haven for corporations.
Oh, wow.
Attracting businesses with its expert legal system and generating significant revenue for the state.
It's like the legal equivalent of a Silicon Valley for businesses.
It is.
We've covered a lot of ground here.
Yeah.
We started with medieval duels, and now we're talking about corporate law in Delaware.
I know, right?
It's clear that American law is built on a foundation of diverse traditions.
It is.
And I'm starting to see how this mix has created a legal system that's both fascinating and incredibly complex.
And this is just the beginning. We've only just scratched the surface of the American legal labyrinth.
Oh, no.
In our next segment, we'll dive deeper into how this complex system actually plays out in practice.
Okay.
And explore the challenges and opportunities it presents for everyday Americans. Stay tuned.
Okay, so we've established that American law is built on this fascinating mix of common law and equity.
Right.
With two separate court systems somehow coexisting.
Yeah.
But how did all of this actually come to America?
That's a good question.
It wasn't like they just shipped over a boatload of law books and called it a day.
Right. It was much more complicated than that.
Yeah.
Imagine America as this vast, untamed garden.
Right.
And each group of colonists is coming in with different seeds, different ideas about how to cultivate this new society.
Okay.
They brought with them not just their hopes and dreams, but their legal traditions and expectations as well.
So it wasn't just a simple transfer of English law.
No.
It sounds like America inherited this patchwork of legal ideas from the very beginning.
Exactly. Remember, the colonists weren't a monolithic group.
Right.
You had Puritans seeking religious freedom in New England, English aristocrats establishing plantations in the South, and various other groups settling in between.
Yeah.
Each with their own distinct legal customs and priorities.
The source material mentions Virginia.
Okay.
Where wealthy landowners were eager to establish large-scale agricultural operations.
Right.
Especially tobacco.
Mm-hmm.
They needed a workforce. And that's where indentured servants came in.
Right. These were people often from England.
Yeah.
Who agreed to work for a set period, typically 7 years, in exchange for passage to the New World.
Got it.
It was a system that offered opportunity for some.
Yeah.
But it was also a form of indentured servitude.
Right.
A way to secure cheap labor for those who controlled the land and resources.
And it wasn't always a voluntary choice.
No, it wasn't.
The source mentions that England also used the colonies as a way to deal with social unrest back home.
Mm-hmm.
They would ship off those considered undesirable, like prisoners,
right,
or those who challenged the authority of the crown.
Yeah, essentially forcing them into indentured servitude.
It's a reminder that the pursuit of freedom and opportunity for some mm-hmm. was often built on the backs of others who were denied those very rights.
That's true.
And as the demand for labor in the colonies grew,
right,
and the supply of indentured servants from England dwindled,
yeah,
the southern plantation owners turned to a new source of forced labor, Africa.
This, of course, marks the beginning of one of the darkest chapters in American history.
Right.
The transatlantic slave trade.
A horrific system where millions of people were captured.
It was.
Transported against their will, treated as property.
Yeah.
And subjected to unimaginable cruelty.
And tragically, the legal system became complicit in this injustice.
You mentioned earlier how common law is built on precedent.
Yes.
Those past decisions that shape future rulings.
Right.
So did the legal system at that time view slavery through this lens of precedent.
That's
drawing on historical justifications for this practice.
It's a complex issue.
Yeah.
And the historical record is full of legal arguments and interpretations mm-hmm. that attempted to rationalize and legitimize the practice of slavery.
Right.
Slaves were categorized as both property and non-citizens.
Wow.
Creating a legal paradox
yeah.
that allowed for their exploitation while denying them basic human rights.
This
fundamental contradiction would ultimately fuel the abolition movement
right.
and the long fight for civil rights in America.
Yeah.
But its legacy continues to resonate in complex ways.
It's heartbreaking to think that this system of oppression was woven into the very fabric of American law.
It is a dark chapter in our history.
Yeah.
And it highlights a crucial point.
Okay.
Legal systems are not static.
Right.
They evolve, they adapt, and they are constantly being challenged and reinterpreted.
Yeah.
The fight to abolish slavery and the ongoing struggle for social justice demonstrate the power of individuals and communities
yeah.
to push back against unjust laws
right.
and demand a legal system that reflects their values.
So we have this backdrop of diverse legal traditions arriving with the colonists,
yeah.
combined with the horrors of slavery and the ongoing struggle for equality.
Right.
It seems like America was destined for a legal system that's anything but simple.
And as the colonies grew and began to develop their own distinct identities,
mm-hmm.
this legal fragmentation became even more pronounced.
Okay.
The source material highlights the stark differences between the legal systems yeah. of neighboring colonies, shaped by factors like religion, economic priorities,
yeah, okay.
and even geographic isolation.
For example, Maryland, with its predominantly Catholic population,
yes.
had a more progressive legal system than Virginia,
right.
which was heavily influenced by the English aristocracy and their desire to maintain control over land and labor.
And as you move further west into the Appalachian region,
right.
you see a legal culture shaped by self-reliance and the right to bear arms,
right.
reflecting the limited reach of government and the need to protect oneself in a rugged and often lawless environment.
It sounds like even before the American Revolution,
yeah.
there was already a sense that one size fits all wouldn't work
right.
when it came to creating a unified legal system for such a diverse and geographically vast land.
Exactly. And this brings us to a pivotal moment.
Okay.
The drafting of the U.S. Constitution.
Oh, wow.
Imagine the founding fathers gathered together.
Yeah.
Each representing a different colony.
Okay.
With its own unique legal traditions and priorities.
Right.
They had to create a framework for a nation, mm-hmm. a set of rules that could somehow accommodate this incredible diversity
right.
while also establishing a sense of unity and shared purpose.
It must have been like trying to herd cats.
It was a monumental task.
How did they even begin to approach such a monumental task?
They recognized that they couldn't simply erase the legal differences
right.
that had emerged among the colonies.
Yeah.
Instead, they opted for a system
mm-hmm.
that acknowledged and respected that diversity
okay.
while also creating a mechanism for addressing issues of national importance.
So they were basically trying to balance the need for national unity
exactly.
with the preservation of states' rights.
Precisely. The Constitution became a blueprint for a federal government with limited powers,
okay.
leaving most legal matters in the hands of the states. Mm-hmm. It's like they built a house with many rooms,
okay.
each decorated differently,
right.
but all connected by a shared foundation.
This explains why we have this dual court system, with federal courts operating alongside state courts.
Yeah, that's right.
It's a way to address issues of national concern, while also allowing states to retain control over their own legal affairs.
And this division of power, this balancing act between federal authority and states' rights has been a source of debate and legal wrangling ever since.
Right.
Think about contemporary issues like gun control, environmental regulations, or even healthcare access.
Okay.
These are all areas where the lines between federal power and states' rights are constantly being tested and redefined.
So the Constitution didn't just create a legal system.
No, it didn't.
It created a framework for ongoing dialogue and debate about the role of government and the balance of power within a diverse and ever-evolving nation.
And this brings us back to our witch and our traveling merchant.
Ah, yes.
Yeah.
Our hypothetical individuals trying to navigate this complex legal landscape.
The Constitution, with its emphasis on individual rights and its creation of a dual court system, aims to protect individuals from potential bias or overreach by any single authority.
So if our witch fears persecution based on her beliefs, or if our merchant believes he will face discrimination in a local court, they have the option of seeking justice in federal court.
Exactly. They have multiple avenues for seeking redress.
So they have multiple layers of protection built into the system.
Exactly. But this also means that navigating the American legal system requires an understanding of both state and federal law, as well as the complex rules that determine which court has jurisdiction over a particular case.
Okay.
It's a system that demands careful consideration of where to file a lawsuit, what legal arguments to make, and even which judge might be most sympathetic to your case.
It sounds like a strategic game of legal chess.
In a way, it is.
Yeah.
And it's a game that many Americans feel ill-equipped to play.
Right.
The source material highlights the fact that many Americans simply ignore aspects of the law because it's just too vast and complex to fully comprehend.
That makes sense.
It's like trying to learn every rule of a sport just to play a casual game with friends.
Yeah.
You'd spend all your time reading rule books and never actually get to enjoy the game itself.
And in the context of American law?
Yes.
This ignore it approach isn't necessarily about willful disregard for the rules.
No, it's not.
It's more about prioritizing, focusing on the laws and regulations that are most relevant to their daily lives.
Right.
And relying on common sense and community norms to fill in the gaps.
So it's a pragmatic adaptation to a system that can feel overwhelming and at times even contradictory.
Precisely. And this reliance on common sense and community standards reflects the historical roots of American law.
Yes.
With its emphasis on local governance and the power of individuals to shape their own legal destiny.
Exactly.
This deep dive has been an incredible journey.
It has.
We've gone from ancient duels to the complexities of constitutional law.
Yeah.
And I'm starting to see how all of these pieces fit together to create this fascinating and often frustrating legal system.
And our exploration isn't over yet.
Oh, no.
In our final segment, we'll delve into the practical implications of this complex system, examining how it affects everyday Americans and how they can navigate this intricate legal landscape to protect their rights and interests.
We've journeyed through centuries of legal history.
Yeah.
Explored the foundations of American law.
We have.
Even witnessed a medieval duel or two along the way.
Right.
But now let's shift our focus to the here and now.
Okay.
How does this complex legal system, with its layers of common law equity and dual courts, actually impact the lives of everyday Americans?
That's the million-dollar question.
Right.
And the answer, as you might expect, is not so simple.
Okay.
One of the most intriguing points raised in this German legal text is the idea that Americans often have to just ignore aspects of the law, simply because it's impossible to keep track of every rule and regulation.
It's like trying to drink from a fire hose of legal jargon.
It is.
There's just so much information, so many different laws at the federal, state, and even local levels that it can feel completely overwhelming.
Exactly. And this ignore it approach isn't about being deliberately lawless. It's more about a learned ability to prioritize.
Right.
Americans tend to focus on the laws that are most relevant to their daily lives, their work, their families, their communities.
So it's a pragmatic adaptation to a system.
It is.
That can feel incredibly complex and at times even contradictory.
Precisely. And this reliance on common sense and community norms actually reflects the historical roots of American law, which often relied on local customs and the judgment of one's peers to resolve disputes.
But let's say our hypothetical listener finds themselves facing a situation where they need to engage with the legal system.
Oh, hey.
Maybe they have a contract dispute with a contractor who's refusing to finish a job.
Right.
Or perhaps they've been injured in a car accident and need to file a claim.
Mm.
Where do they even begin?
That's where things can get tricky.
Yeah.
One of the first hurdles is figuring out which court has jurisdiction over your case.
Okay.
Remember, we have this dual court system with federal courts operating alongside state courts.
Right.
Each with their own specific areas of authority.
So it's not as simple as just walking into any courthouse and filing a lawsuit.
Not quite. You need to determine whether your case falls under federal jurisdiction or state jurisdiction.
Got it.
For example, if your case involves a federal law.
Okay.
Like a violation of a federal environmental regulation or a dispute over a patent,
mm-hmm.
you'd likely need to file your lawsuit in federal court.
And if it's a more localized issue, like a contract dispute or a property disagreement with a neighbor, you'd head to state court.
Exactly. But there are also some interesting exceptions.
Okay.
Remember our traveling merchant from earlier? He was worried about facing bias in a local court. So he explored the option of filing his lawsuit in federal court.
Ah, yes. That's where diversity jurisdiction comes in.
Right. If the parties involved in a lawsuit are from different states
mm-hmm.
and the amount of money in dispute meets a certain threshold,
okay.
they can opt to have their case heard in federal court.
So it's a way to provide a more neutral playing field to ensure that someone from out of state isn't at a disadvantage.
It is.
When facing a legal battle in a potentially hostile local court.
Exactly. And this concept of ensuring fairness, of protecting individual rights, is woven throughout the American legal system,
yeah.
even amidst its complexities.
But this jurisdictional maze doesn't end there, does it?
It doesn't.
We also talked about personal jurisdiction.
Right.
Which determines whether a court can even make a ruling that's binding on a specific person.
It's about establishing a connection, a legal hook,
Mm.
that gives the court authority over an individual. And this can get really complicated, especially in our increasingly interconnected world.
Think about online businesses, for example.
Okay.
If someone in California buys a product from an online retailer based in New York,
right.
and there's a dispute over the sale, which state's courts have jurisdiction?
That's a great example of how technology is blurring jurisdictional lines.
Right.
Courts are constantly grappling with these issues, trying to determine when online interactions or transactions
yeah.
are enough to establish personal jurisdiction.
And this is where those long-arm statutes come in.
Exactly.
Those laws that allow courts to reach across state lines to serve defendants.
But there are limits to this power.
Yep.
Courts can't just haul someone into their jurisdiction willy-nilly.
Right.
They need to demonstrate that the defendant has sufficient minimum contacts with the state.
Mm.
to make it fair for them to defend themselves there.
So sending a few emails or making a couple of online purchases from another state probably isn't enough to subject you to their court's jurisdiction.
Likely not, but if you have a more substantial connection, like an ongoing business relationship or a physical presence in the state, even for a short period, you might find yourself subject to their legal authority.
It sounds like navigating this jurisdictional maze can be a real challenge, even for those who are familiar with the law.
It's true. And this brings us back to the point raised in the source material.
Okay.
The idea that Americans often have to ignore aspects of the law.
Right.
Because it's simply too vast and complex to fully grasp.
But this doesn't mean they're living in a state of legal anarchy.
No, it doesn't.
It's more about a pragmatic approach, a reliance on common sense community norms.
Right.
And a belief that the system, despite its flaws, ultimately aims to ensure fairness and protect individual rights.
And that's a key takeaway from this deep dive of the American legal system for all its complexities and contradictions is a reflection of the American experience.
Okay.
It's a system that values individual liberty, embraces diversity, and strives to provide a framework for resolving disputes peacefully and justly.
We've explored the historical roots of this system. From medieval duels to the drafting of the U.S. Constitution.
We have.
We've delved into the intricacies of common law equity and the dual court system.
Right.
And we've examined how Americans navigate this intricate legal landscape, relying on a mix of pragmatism, common sense, and a belief in the enduring power of the law.
It's a system that is constantly evolving, adapting to new challenges, and reinterpreting old precedents.
It is.
And as you continue your exploration of American law,
okay,
remember that it's not just a collection of rules and regulations.
Right.
It's a reflection of who we are as a nation, a testament to our ongoing pursuit of a more perfect union.
We've only scratched the surface.
We have.
But I hope this deep dive has sparked your curiosity.
Me too.
And given you a new appreciation for the fascinating and, yes, sometimes frustrating role of American law.
Absolutely.
And if you ever find yourself facing a legal challenge, remember the words of the great Supreme Court Justice, Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr., who said, "The life of the law has not been logic, it has been experience."
That's a good one.
So embrace the journey, seek guidance when needed,
right,
and never stop learning. The pursuit of justice is a lifelong endeavor.
It is